Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to NeuroNoodles Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring tech legend Jake Gunkelman. He's the man who has read well over 500,000 brain scans, and Dr. Marie Swingle, author of iMinds. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. The NeuroNoodle Podcast is supported by listeners and businesses just like you. Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as the featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
There we are.
Demarie Swingle.
Hello. A different background today.
Yes, I'm hiding in the mountains.
which mountains, Dr. Marie?
Whistler.
Where's that?
Where's that? That's the West Coast. One of the best skiing resorts. There's a little plug for my local mountains. What's that? I thought you were a supreme athlete. Does this only involve football, Pete?
Skiing? I'll sink. Is this in Canada or U.S.?
Canada.
Yeah. Canada, okay.
Above Vancouver, yeah.
It's where James Thompson learned all of his skiing and ended up as a ski coach at Penn State.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. But the Thompson family, I know, came up here quite regularly.
Yeah. In fact, Michael Thompson, when he was still alive and kicking, and he did kick, you know, he skied down, he raced Barry Sturman down the mountain and went and beat him. And Barry said, "It's no fair. You've got braces."
Had to come up with a reason, right?
Oh, well, you know, you can kick in those edges. You don't have ankles that twist and stuff. So but, you know, Michael was quite active physically. He, you know, he was a character. I miss him.
Well, let's see. PTSD's in the news. Elders doing mind game books to keep their brain health when they could be doing brain brightening. What strikes your fancy, team?
Wow. You gave us a lot. Where do we jump in, Jay?
Well, you know, seniors, why not, you know? there have been online things that give you brain games to keep you sharp, and they've made claims.
Yeah.
And the difficulty with that is that the FDA pays attention to people who make psychological and neurological and medical claims. And if you claim to make people sharper and brighter and less demented, you better have your data together. Mm-hmm. The online gamified crossword puzzly, wordly sort of approaches to maintaining cognitive function really don't do anything. I was going to be a little grosser on that, but
I'm going to name the first company to go down. It was Luminosity. They made outrageous claims about curing dementia and Alzheimer's. And the really good news is the American Board of Trade throw the book at them. Now there's a little bit of a catch though. I'm going to get my numbers off. It was either $1 or $2 million, but they got a nice fine. But all they did was mildly change. They kind of disappeared for a little bit, and then they mildly changed the phrasing of their advertising. So essentially, they took out the word Alzheimer's, but they're going heavy. And here I can go on and on and on, because this actually was some of my research. I can't take full credit. A lot of people were involved, but there were improvements. Okay. But what they found is it was actually a social connection. So if individuals would play these games at a community center or in an elder center, they actually saw improvements. But when individuals played these at home, they didn't get improvements. So it's about who you're playing the games with, not whether you're playing them or not. The other really interesting thing is if people played these more than 3 times a week, it actually went the other way. Okay. So I think we're getting into, it's just about the arousal. It's not about actually using any parts of your brain or exercising or maintaining any parts of your brain. So
it becomes more like being stuck on your tablet or iPad or something when you're doing it that often.
Yeah, exactly. So I always say, if you want to play them for fun, who am I to say to not play them for fun? Eat a little bit of candy. But if you think that this is what's going to keep you sharp, no sir, no ma'am.
Playing bridge with a group or canasta. I don't even know what the hell canasta is, but I hear canasta is played a lot. But there's lots of group games, puzzles, spatial puzzle things. If you're working them together with other people, you're having social interaction, and that's positive. You don't have to pay some fee online to have a 10,000 piece puzzle put together on a tabletop, you know?
No. So when my mom's telling me to bring her over some puzzle books because she wants to keep her brain sharp, that's for enjoyment. That's not for sharpness.
If she works.
No, puzzle books. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If she works with the other folks on those puzzles, then it's all the better.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But let me parse this out. So level the one that it just has all the hype around it are the games on your phone or your tablet or your computer. Okay. Again, if you want to eat a little bit of candy, eat a little bit of candy, but don't think that you're getting your vitamin C from it, right? The second level would be any type of cognitive tasking, any type of game that involves cognitive tasking. Solitary is fine. You're going to keep the brain a little bit brighter, but the maximum is cognitive tasking in an interactive social format. So these are things like bridge, blackjack even, not that I endorse people going to the casinos and spending their money, but you can play home games, like what we used to call penny poker, matchstick, blackjack. You don't have to pay, you don't have to get the monetary reward. You can have those type of things.
But not slot machines, right?
No, because you're laughing.
I'm dead serious. It's my mom, she sees these magazines that say, protect your brain health, buy this puzzle book, see what the different, what are the differences in the pictures. I'm like, they can't be, does that really work? That's all I want to know.
I would say yes. And there's, it's certainly better than just sitting nothing, passively watching the television and the negative news, generally speaking, on television. Okay. Or, the shows that always have a cliffhanger. They keep you either in depression or anticipatory anxiety. So in that
Hallmark
sense,
Channel.
Yeah, well, even those supposedly slow Cinderella movies now are full of angst, you know. Yeah. No, so okay. Puzzle books are good. They are fun. But if she wants to play that with a grandchild, that would be wonderful. She's doing something, the grandchild is doing something. The slot machines, again, you're doing absolutely nothing except playing with your arousal template. There's no cognitive brightening whatsoever.
Bling, 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 bling,
bling. No. But the games.
And nowadays, you don't even have to get the arm strength of the lever. True, yeah. You're hitting a button nowadays. So,
Max.
Yeah. But the reason why I mentioned blackjack is you have to count, right? You have to add and you have to add quickly. And there's a limit to the adding. So essentially you're doing some fun mathematics. Now that doesn't work on a computer because the computer will do it for you. So any game where you're not involved in the mathematics yourself, forget it. And I think that's the major issue when things are delivered on the computer, they do the work for you. So bridge is a good one.
What about music, learning an instrument or something?
Absolutely. There you go.
Yeah. You learning, leading, or am I leading?
Learning something new. And music is one of the best things to learn that's new. And in fact, in schools that drop the music program, what suffers worst is math. Because the same basic areas of the brain end up being fostered. And you might think, well, what? Where's the music area? You know, but you end up having to use proportions and things such as that, and patterns, and all of that stuff ends up being the three dimensional higher level mathematics that you're going to end up having to use as well. So, you can't cut out art and music and end up expecting the students to flourish elsewhere.
Triple, you know, underscore what Jay said. When you take out the arts, okay, when you take out the music program, the math scores go down. Like, I don't know why this isn't just flashing all over the place. Arts get a horrible rap, but as Jay was saying, the integration of information, the pattern recognition is huge. And if you also look at what children are learning to do, many musical instruments, they separate out coordination of the right and the left. Okay. In piano, the hands are doing something very different. In violin, in wind instruments, you're matching breathing patterns to percussion, to finger play. So what's the learning that's going on in music is phenomenal. Right. I'm going to overtly say it. We're idiots to take out the music program. Idiots.
I have to say, I have a sister who did a 4-year music program in 2.5 years and can play any instrument you hand her. Mm-hmm. And she has a Steinway and a Yamaha grand piano in her house. The Steinway's for her. The Yamaha's for adults who are good at music or taking higher end music lessons from her. Mm-hmm. But development of the brain when you're learning music ends up being really quite accelerated. And you can see kids who end up picking up instruments and actually doing well playing an instrument, ending up in a social setting, in a band. You know, not all of them end up having to play bass in the back like Pete, but, you know, but the, you know, and speaking of that, Pete, the Heart of Glass is looking fabulous as a tribute band. So
we love Blondie.
Yeah, but no, it's the social component as well. You know, whether it's guitar or whatnot, that ability for that to move out of the classroom, and it's not just the ability. So frequently it does. I think there's a good component there also for all the parents out there. To know that there are two ways to learn music. You know, one is your conservator beating somebody with a ruler or a metronome. And the other is, you know, a free jazz play. Now, I've polarized those intentionally. It's a false polarization. But just to know that there are components of rigid learning in music, and then there are components of amusement, and where individuals get the most enjoyment is when you have a little bit of those. So you have the formal schooling and the play. But yeah, please. Of course, do neuro. The best thing you can do for your kids is music. Shall we slide into second language learning then?
Yeah. There you go. That's a fabulous addition as well. Mm-hmm. Music, another language. Actually, mathematics. Some mm-hmm. people don't think, mathematics is something to study. But also you can end up having a deeper knowledge in mathematics. That's almost like an art. So
I don't differentiate them. I mean, if you take higher levels of mathematics, it is art. And I would say our in the classics, we never differentiated math from art. They were one and the same. It's we idiotic modern people that parse it out. I mean, if you look at perspective, if you don't have basic visual math, you can't draw perspective.
I would say your basic math is left hemispheric, linear logic, ABC, 1, 2, 3. But when you get to higher mathematics, geometry is spatial. But beyond that, linear algebra, which is data matrices and rotating them in three-dimensional space. I mean, if you don't have your right hemisphere added into your repertoire, not just left hemispheric, you're not going to get that kind of math. Yeah. Calculus is one step above that, but it's not much of a step. I mean, the linear algebra is right in there with calculus. And if you're doing QEGs, it's linear algebra. Whether you realize it or not, you may not know the math. You might just hit the button on the software, but actually understanding what's going on underneath it all.
You put in the connections here, what we're talking about. You know, you have your basic solfège, right? So you learn your do, re, mi, or your ABC in music. You learn your ABCs in language. You learn your 1, 2, 3 in math. So, you know, there are these basic components, as you said, that involve the left. And then all of a sudden, zoot, and you get that integration. Everybody, I don't care what age, music, math, second language, keep us all super duper bright. And let's go in the physical, right?
And we end up being able to assist in some circumstances when kids run into difficulties with some kinds of processing. There is a pattern that you can see there's a couple of major features that you can see in dyslexia. One of them is delta in parietal area. That's sensory integration. It's not just dyslexia, but it's all sensory integration. Dyslexia actually is Wernicke's area, the left temporal parietal junction. Mm-hmm. And that actually has a genetic marker associated with it. So, but we can end up training people to activate those brain areas so you can actually, you know, get past the lexical processing problem using neurofeedback and other techniques. Undoubtedly, neuromodulation has a lot of tricks in the tool belt, not just neurofeedback.
Can I get on my soapbox here? Terms of, you know, all the work that I've done, I don't know how much people know about my earlier work, but my earlier work was primarily with children, educational and behavioral issues, which kind of mesh because a lot of behavioral issues are essentially behavioral manifestations of frustration due to troubles with learning. But I have encountered so very, very, very few what I call true dyslexics. So when, for all of you out there, when you have somebody come in with either a diagnosis of dyslexia or of suspicion of it, sure, check out what Jay was talking about, the delta. There are markers in the brain, but for the majority of individuals, kick out that label as soon as you can. These are just not phonetic readers. They need to track, okay? Which is essentially they need to track the letters as opposed to the sounds of the letters. And that you can do, you know, just with very, very, you know, what we used to do for standard ADHD, you know, bring down some of that slow activity, help the kids to focus, and teach them a different method without the label and the accommodations. Jay, how many folks, what do you think the population now is of true dyslexia?
Well, you, the true dyslexia is the trick. Lexical processing can end up being a general sensory integration problem, and that, you know, that can end up being, I would say, misdiagnosed, but ultimately you get the same diagnosis again and again and again. So it's not a misdiagnosis, it's that the diagnosis isn't valid. And that's the DSM problem. There are people that have dyslexia that have inversions and reversals spatially, and they have a great deal of difficulty perceiving the just ABC 1, 2, 3 of it all. And that's usually the left posterior temporal parietal junction. You can map it out on, if you see the cortex, it's just below on the temporal lobe, adjacent to it, and it's auditory and visual and kinesthetic integration. So and it's not only left hemispheric, there's also the prosodic content of that on the right side. So you're pairing up kind of the tone of what's being spoken with the actual words, you know.
There's another component, though, in terms of, you know, how quickly we get on things. So when we talk about, you know, kids, they're taking a child, a five-year-old in for behavior issues because they're rolling around on the floor yelling. Well, hey, welcome to being five. And that's where I also get into letter reversal. I mean, there's a real reason why when we pretend to be children, we write with reverse letters. This is absolutely standard. It's a matter of training the brain to recognize the direction of the culture. If you look at reading and writing, it's 100% arbitrary. Okay. Some languages write from left to right, others right to left, some up, down, others down, up. And then, you know, we throw a child in front of our writing system or the culturally bound arbitrary system and then say, hey, they can't read. So this is absolutely natural. And sometimes it's just our failing in terms of not explicitly letting certain children know that they have to track in a specific direction. This is, you know, some it's learned by osmosis and others no. So that again is the point in terms of when we're talking about the true blue dyslexia, where things continue to float and land on the page after a certain age.
All right. Let me get you guys going.
The difficulty there is that we've added in not just the perception of the letter directionality and dyslexia, but also the ability to read, which is the frontal eye fields. You'd think vision is all in the back of the head, but the accommodation and convergence, how you point your eyes, not what direction the E is pointing in the doctor's office, that's acuity. You know, that has to do with how accurate your eyes are at perception. You know, that's the 20/20 of it all. But you can have 20/20 vision and not be able to read because you can't pass your eyes across the page and track. So you're focused here, but as you go across the page, the page is a little closer over here. You have to change your focus. You have to track with your eyes. All of those things don't work if the frontal lobes aren't working. And in what conditions do we see frontal lobes not working? Attention and affect problems. In ADD, it's not uncommon to see visual tracking problems. And in depression and mania and psychiatric problems, it's also not uncommon to see, you know, visual tracking issues. So again, it's not all vision at the back and lexical perception left posteriorly. You've got to be able to read by focusing your eyes and working them, and the frontal lobes have to be intact for that.
I wouldn't mind doing a shout out here, Pete, where you can edit or put it in, but I don't know, whatever happened to those wonderful tracking devices, the late 90s, early 2000s, they were magnificent complementary tools. And I don't know about anybody else, but ours busted and we're never able to replace them. There's a lot of flashy things out there, but those really old-fashioned tracking procedures, they were coming out of Eastern Europe. Jay, do you know what I'm talking about?
There are eye tracking.
Yeah.
The ability to see where your eyes are focused.
Yeah.
And they usually have essentially a laser pointed at your eye, and they'll kind of track where your eye is pointed. They can't necessarily see whether it's focused or not, but they can see what direction your eye is pointing.
This was really low tech, really low tech. It was
talking about like Simon, where you follow the procedure, the flashing lights from the 80s.
No, the flashing lights are testing your peripheral vision and to make sure you've got all four quadrants going on, you know. I can't talk about driver's licenses. I don't have any anymore, you know. But, you know, seeing the rearview mirror on the left side is really kind of impossible for me. And the cataract on the right side is getting too blurry for a distant vision of even with glasses. So it is best to keep me off the road.
Jay, Dr. Marie, you guys keep bringing up math, and I'm thinking about kids in school and the problems that I had in school and what math I'm using today. And everybody's complaining about how we're falling behind in test scores. Is math really that, besides the basic elements of math, are we spending too much time on the process versus the input and output so kids can learn to critical think? Like, here's the problem and then work your way backwards. What do you think?
In fact, that logic and process is really the important part. The basics of memory, memorizing the multiplication tables or just basic number processing, addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. Those processes are basic, but they're useful in life. You never ever thought when I was taking algebra or linear algebra that I was going to end up using that on a day-to-day basis. I mean, if you would have told me I would have laughed. You know, what are you, crazy? This stuff, you know, but here it is. You know, EEG, QEG is full of data matrices that are getting rotated around for various analytics and, you know, zeroing out a matrix and, ICA technology and so forth. So the high level math is there for some specialization. But having just the basic understanding of the logic and processing is I think critical. Critical thinking is critical. And
before we change the onto like put a tab in, because I would love to jump on critical thinking. But we go so fast here. But yeah, I mean, for better or for worse, we put a high social value on mathematics. Okay. And there's absolutely no question whatsoever that math is a gatekeeper to the great profession. So I always say, do not drop out of math until you really, really need to, like at least grade 10, get there. But one of the key things I have noticed that there are, you know, just the way people have language aptitudes, people have mathematical aptitudes or lack thereof. And one of the things that I've noticed is there are individuals, you teach math and it just kind of stays and they build and they build. There are other individuals where there's some kind of, I would say, neuronal pruning, meaning if they don't use it on a regular basis, it is gone.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.
So if you have a child that had some trouble learning their times tables, it's true, it's gone over the summer. So these individuals, you have to literally keep it. It's one of those, if you don't use it, you'll lose it. And maybe Jay can pipe in here. I actually think it's a sign of a very intelligent brain, but a different one. Because, you know, why would we keep all this quote unquote useless knowledge? Why does the brain perceive numerical calculations as something to really hold on to in one brain and the other one doesn't? But in the, rotate again, because I think it's really important. Culturally, it's imperative for those individuals or the children that don't hold it. You just have to beat it in. I need better words. You just have to
beat's good. Practice.
Get myself in trouble. No, you just have to practice. For those of you working with kids, low high alpha, train low high alpha, get alpha down in the front, and the numbers tend to stick a little bit more. But Jay, do you have any commentary in terms of why, you know, many kids, this is very, very common. It's gone if you don't use it regularly.
You ever heard of flashcards?
Yeah.
And repetition. It's not beating it into them, but things that are repeated end up getting burned in. And that's what you have to do. That the multiplication tables end up having to be part of your burned in repertoire, hardwired, and they're a table that's a lookup table once you know them.
Yeah.
But until you know them, you're going to be missing that lookup table that's going to help you later. Mm-hmm. And it may seem painful, but flashcards and the basic repetition ends up being absolutely essential. Yeah. And it works eventually. If the child has severe attentional problems, it's going to be delayed. If they have a learning disability, it's going to be delayed. But those have to be addressed on an individual basis.
By the way, this is the one, and I'm going to say the one exception. I'm very, very down on computer-assisted learning for any of the language arts. But one exception is the really boring mathematics. This is one area where gamification and using the computer programs actually can be very helpful.
Don't take
that out of context.
I'm not taking it out of context, but I think it's... Jay, what was it, the early 70s, right when you were starting neurofeedback? Didn't that little calculator come out with the red LED lights, right, dividing?
Yeah, and pretty soon people wouldn't have to ever learn how to use a slide ruler.
Right. Why are we not using a slide ruler? So I think
do you even know anybody who has a slide ruler? And if they have one, do they know how to use them? You know, so there are archaic techniques. I mean, an abacus is a great thing if you know how to use it. But
right.
Who does? You know,
and kind of where I'm going, guys, is where AI is coming in. It's more important to know what the right question is to figure out what the solution is that you're trying to get to than getting caught in the weeds of that stuff, because it turns a lot of people off. hey, it worked for you, Jay, but how many people in this world have read over a million brain scans? You know what I mean? We're talking about the general public here, and you have kids coming out of school with no real life skills. So that's why I'm bringing it up. So what can you do in the left hemisphere to, instead of, hey, there's our guy.
My apologies. The dog is bringing me his treats for me to toss back to him. So, well, you know, it makes for an exciting morning with him jumping up and down on the chair.
Absolutely. But what is the part of the brain that says, you can see all these numbers because you have, I'm getting ahead of my skis here. You have autistic people out there, people with a really honed skill that can do multiplication tables all day, but they can't do anything
else. Savant.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the old term idiot savant, but you know, the idiot is a little bit too like insulting. So savant is the special skill, and you can have a special skill and not be so autistic that you can't function.
Well,
so,
getting back to music. Okay. I don't know anything about music theory. Okay. It's like code. Okay. Instead of
learning code.
It's code. And you can learn tabs, which are just numbers and frets to get going and play, or you can learn music forever and it turns people off versus getting the music in your heart, then figuring it out. And that's kind of where I'm bringing out is where the kids are learning today is that, do we got to make changes on it and which part of the brain, or it's all the same stuff. I just, you know, critical thinking, where is that?
Let's jump in as well. I think one of the key errors that we make in North America is we actually start too young, which is interesting because, you know, I'd say from the 80s onward, there was a big push, whether it was in affluent families, like really starting a major, major top-down learning, you know, with babies, and then, you know, No Child Left Behind programs, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at school systems where the general level of completion, and I would also say where the skills learned do flow into better careers, for lack of other way of saying things, is when they start the formal learning later, as late as 7. Okay. What you want is exposure. Before you want curiosity, so exposure to numbers and exposure to letters. If you start training this rote memory when children are far too young, first of all, they have no concept of what the purpose of this is for. And then all of a sudden, especially in math, you start talking about 3 elephants and 5 oranges. What? You know, how many oranges did an elephant eat? The kids like, do elephants eat oranges? You know, like I think we really have to strip down the system a little bit, get back to exposure, and then get formal when the children have the, I would say, rational capacity, intellectual capacity, emotional capacity, behavioral capacity.
Cortical connectivity.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Just to be able to absorb some of these things. And that's very, very key in math. We do it too young.
If you look at very, very young kids, their dominant brain activity in you know, 6 months old, 1 year old, is in the delta range. They might have a little bit in the theta range.
That's
awfully slow. Yeah. And their thalamus has to mature. Yeah. And as it matures, it speeds up. Now, at age 3, where most people start to have their first memory about at age 3, the cortex is starting to get up to the alpha frequencies where you might hit 8, but you could be 6, 7, 8, but you could be 7, 8, 9, too, depending upon the maturational development. And kids can have a developmental advance or decline above and beyond normal range. So you've got to be a little bit cautious. In fact, historically, they looked at the multivariate analysis scatter of the data of the EEG of kids And they would take that multivariate scatter, which has a Mahalanobis distance from the centroid. What's the scatter? How distant is the scatter? So there's a three-dimensional multivariate statistic that's summarized as a distance. Well, if you take the patient's data and you ascribe it to an earlier age, does it make it look more normal? then this is just a developmental delay. But if you move it earlier and it doesn't make it more normal, this is just a developmental deviation. And that statistical trick was used in Roy John's NXLink database. The dog is running around whining about his treat that he carries around.
That's a really good point, Jay, too, because, you know, what we have the age factor. I know, Pete, we've talked about this with sports as well. You know, depending on when you were born and when you get integrated into the school system, you can literally have, you know, 11 and a half months developmental difference in children. Yeah. And for many, when children start school, that's a quarter of a lifetime. So the variation and the abilities are huge. Yeah. And we ascribe the children that are a little bit younger as a little bit more delayed. The stats are all over the place now, which I love, you know, how the children with ADHD, when you actually look at their birth date, they're all clustered. They're all the younger kids. It's not a learning disability, it's being younger.
You've also got differences between male and female developmentally. Yeah. If you track them across time, you may actually end up seeing that they're out of phase. One will have a developmental surge, the other one's not. And if you have two things that are out of phase and you average them, what do you get? Something you'd want to be compared to. You know, the databases that don't separate male and female during the developmental trajectory are missing it really badly, because during that active developmental phase, if you hang out with younger kids in a school setting, in elementary school, you'll see the surges. One school year, the girls are all shooting up larger developmentally, and earlier the males may have had a developmental surge. But you see that they're happening in different time domain. The Koreans, bless their heart for doing all the hard work separating male and female data, based on my guess that there was a difference. And you know, it gave them a 5-year data collection instead of a 2.5-year data collection. So it was really a lot of work, but it turned out to be extremely valuable, because now you can see. Now, also the HBI database in Europe doubled up their database and split male and female. So you know, but you can't just split a database in half and say you've got a male and female. You have to actually have complete database statistical numbers. So you can't take a database of 1,000, split it in half. Two 500s don't make a database. So it's been very good to see that at this point they've got the technical capability of actually looking at this developmental detail in very young kids.
Dr. Marie, like you always said, especially with the boys, I mean, they got to get some of that energy out. So recess is important. Okay. And they have to be ready to accept the information to process it till that's done. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't they also like do alpha theta training in schools to get, you know, you get the physical energy done and then, you know, get the mind right to accept, or no?
I don't have the answer. I mean, I really fight on this, you know, in terms of, do we use this as an enhancement tool, you know, peak performance on wee ones, or do we essentially let nature play its course? And if it looks like somebody is having a little bit of trouble, we boost them along. I tend to prescribe to the latter. And I think, I don't know how many people, again, I'm going back to my history, but I used to work, you know, curriculum development, did a lot in second language acquisition, and worked, you know, I worked a lot with adults, but the younger folks that I did work with, they were with parents pushing them, pushing them, pushing them. They wanted more and more and more for their kids to get ahead. And you want to talk about unhappy individuals and anxiety disorders. And I completely dropped working with accelerated learning. I mean, there were some exceptions. I went into remedial because I thought, you know, just ethically, it was wrong. So I don't have the answer. I mean, if we use these tools, I mean, it's the classic. If you use the tools wisely, and we always, you know, check not just forward, but left, right, and back in terms of the effects we're having, then I could support it. But I don't know whether I trust ourselves not to.
It's not like one thing needs to fit everybody. We need to personalize what people have have access to, but the things that they need, that they need to individualize. Evidence-based, but personalized as well. Not just, well, there's evidence for this. Well, there's evidence for that for these personal specific applications. And for those who think that neurofeedback and the neuromodulation stuff is not being picked up by medicine and used, you have to look internationally. Right now, the Koreans have the pediatricians in Korea, large pediatrician groups having adopted EEG screening for adolescents and children, and in a major way to try to help guide them with medication and to help with them diagnostically. So we've got I think some substantial steps up in the acceptance of neurofeedback and the neuroscience of EEG, QEG for clinical use. Right now in psychiatry, they don't look at EEG typically. You know, some do, but it's not part of the routine standard practice. And in neurology, half the neurologists don't really believe in the EEG. You show them an abnormal EEG and say, well, we don't treat the EEG. Who do you think made the EEG? You know, I mean, I didn't use a Sharpie, honest, you know, this isn't, you know, a weather map with a Sharpie drawn on it. We've actually recording EEGs off of patients, and when they have epileptiform content, you need to actually treat them. Neurologists who won't treat unless you're having a seizure, I point to a paper that we published, and it showed 85% positive improvement in psychiatric patients when you see an epileptiform burst if you give them an anticonvulsant. They're not having seizures. They've never had a seizure. They probably never will have a seizure. But you're giving them an anticonvulsant, and they're improving psychiatrically because they've got epileptiform discharges that are not convulsing, but they're disturbing brain function. And the neurologist would deny service to 85% of the clinical population. We have evidence-based and personalized medicine evidence that they should be treating them. So there's a whole sea change in epileptology and neurology going on. In the U.S., they still talk about benign Rolandic epilepsy, but internationally, it's now being called Rolandic epilepsy because it's not benign. You need to treat it. You get better life outcomes when you treat it. So,
looking back, though, I think the two places that I not only like beyond support having the EEG is a pediatrician and a geriatrician. I think if we're going to invest in the healthcare, those are the, you know, bookend, and then we can kind of creep through. No, what the Koreans are doing, it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant. They're on it.
The ability to look at the brain deteriorating ends up being able to categorize fairly well and prognosticate. If the EEG recording doesn't give you any value, why do it? But if it gives you good value, the ability to predict, you know, if you're looking at somebody who's got cognitive decline, it's pretty substantial. They're going to want to know, what's my next few years going to have for me? Yeah. If you look at their EEG, you can tell them at that point, get your affairs in order quickly, because 2 years from now, you're going to be in full care.
Yeah.
Or 2 years from now, you'll be at home with some assistance. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference in that. And you can usually identify that based on the background EEG. And that's being seen not only with the AI, with the Korean database, but also Leslie Prichip and NYU's Brain Research Lab had turned out in 2008 a replication of work that they had done in the 90s that looked at prediction 26 months out for Alzheimer's. And
let's not forget, though, that if, I mean, Alzheimer's is in its own unique box, but for most age-related cognitive decline, as well as for budding dementia, you not only can see the trajectory, you can slow it. So that's, I think, again, why we should have this, you know, for geriatric checkup. Hey, you know, and if you want the argument, whether it's for the insurance companies or the government in general, the cost of you know, the negative end of life as opposed to the, you know, the last hurrah, you know, if we invest really with the pop, hey, we're coming full circle, the brain training. brain training.
There's good solid research on outcomes on training and treatments. And when mild cognitive impairment is identified, intervening to maintain the level of cognitive function so you don't end up slipping down into a dementia is something that has been hoped about. And now the treatments are actually being validated. The Koreans have large community health managers in areas kind of like a small township that has to be managed by a health manager. Well, they're doing the mild cognitive impairment evaluations, and they're doing photobiomodulation. And so it's being applied routinely on a day-to-day basis. It's being managed by the routine healthcare system in Korea. And they've got control group of people who aren't getting it that have the same kind of testing. They've showed at this point with 8 weeks only, they've shown good differentiation between the treatment and control group. The control group being basically treatment as usual. And that means you're, you know, slowly declining. So their evidence is really quite good. They're working with major groups in the U.S. and Canada also, looking at providing evidence for their outcomes. So they're not just developing the hardware and trying to sell it with a claim. They're actually providing the evidence that their claims.
Data.
Yeah. The show me the data is there before the show me the sales slip, you know?
Yeah. That nothing gets me on my soapbox as much as that. But let's not also forget, I mean, we're really focused a lot on cognitive decline of elders, but the depression as well as the anxiety, more anxiety in females and more depression in males. There's your gender issue there as well. But so much that can really, really affect the sharpness or the brightness of the individual. So please also check your depression markers as well as your anxiety markers.
Yeah. Very difficult determination clinically. Is this depression or cognitive decline?
Bingo.
And the EEG is a great differentiator.
It's a differentiator, I would say.
Yeah. And if you end up not looking and can't tell the difference, the treatment for them differs so dramatically.
Yeah.
So, and you know, depression now has a lot of neural treatments. There's TMS, TDCS, various pharmacological agents that can intervene, neuromodulation, thalamocortical dysrhythmia at the anterior cingulate. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of ways to intervene if you see what the problem is. But if you don't look to see what the problem is, the treatments, you could be giving the treatment for dementia to somebody who's got depression. And, you know, Aricept isn't really an antidepressant. You know, Aricept is for dementia, and you're not going to get the outcome you're expecting. So
Montessori schools, I think, isn't that what the program is? Kids want to learn what they want to learn and facilitate. No.
Well, there's, like many things, there's a bastardization. Okay, a true Montessori, it isn't about kids running around doing whatever the heck they want to do. Yeah. You know, it's exposure. Exposure in a learning environment, a social environment.
Enriched environment as well.
Sorry?
An enriched environment.
Exactly, extremely enriched environment. Yeah, but I mean, for every school that has the Montessori sign out, you know, there are lesser and lesser that really do it. But true Montessori, in these enriched and somewhat, I don't want to say dangerous, but they're not. the way you learn how to cut is with scissors.
Exactly.
They're not cut. Yeah. Like, they're enriched in many, many ways.
There's playground equipment I had when I was a kid that they don't make anymore for a reason, you know. You know, it was an enriched environment. You learn vertical fairly quickly, you know.
Not restricted, enriched, and you know, and there are levels and scales when a child is ready. But I think the key thing, instead of doing whatever they want, is they do not push the child before the child is perceived as ready within self.
Yeah,
that's a good way to put it.
And that was my point with the EEG, whatever piques their interest to make sure that they're at a, I don't want to say level playing field, but some baseline there, just to say, okay, if there's a learning disability coming down the road that can be predicted, or if something happens and there is a learning disability that, you know, that's happening, there's something to go back. And I bring up Montessori schools because I'm under the impression that they would be more into that than the regular union school system, that, you know, that's all.
Well, let's also say that the Montessori schools, they're small enough where the teachers actually know the children. And they can see, as Jay said, if somebody's literally going through a growth phase, you know, their pants become too short. You know, there's an attention to detail, I would say, that's very, very positive. Yeah, institutional schools are institutional schools. You know,
our school systems also have local control, and every local school district can vary so dramatically from the next one. It's really quite astounding.
My point is, if we're going to put EEG in, you know, public schools, institutional schools, you're really going to have strong, knowledgeable leadership. I mean, looping back to what was a Yonkers, New York, I'll give a shout out to Mary Jo Sabo. Wow, she was doing really cool stuff in the late 90s, you know, so there's precedent for this.
Yeah.
You know, some of the earlier schools that, you know, we at the Swingle Clinic were helping with, you know, we were sending out harmonics and people would go, you know, just put on their little devices, very simple devices, and just take simple time, you know, time out. But with some form of modulation. So a lot of the newer equipment coming out, I would say, if we're cautious about it, if it's appropriately tested, if it actually does what it says it does, if the electrodes actually are picking up brain activity as not, then there's a space for this. But let's be really cautious in terms of what we literally put on little children's brains or heads. I'm not sure we're completely there yet. Jay, am I being too conservative?
No. We have a wide variety of approaches, and there should be, because there's a wide variety of different needs. And that I think one of the things that's difficult in some of the school systems that are routine is that they're a little bit too regimented. And if you don't fit their specific model, you end up kind of getting bounced out. I saw yesterday from Fargo had a school, Fargo Central High, which burned down eventually, but kids that went there still have a chat group. So one of the teachers, Horrible Helen, passed away at 95.
Matthew.
And one of the kids said that he spent almost his entire class sitting in the hall on the ground, because if you weren't acting properly, she would send you out to sit outside the sit on the ground outside the schoolroom in the hall. And and she also had a pointer that could be used rather aggressively. So, but it, every school district is dramatically different, and you may end up having an old classic teacher that will whack you with a ruler, and be a disciplinarian, but you may end up having something where if you act up at all, you're sent to the principal's office and given detention, and
Well, one of the things I think we really need to be careful about, and I did write about this in the book as well, that, in terms of educating skills and parenting skills, we went from the ruler to Ritalin. Okay. So essentially we went from punishing and literally hurting children for them to pay attention to medicating children to pay attention. And I think one of the key things that we all need to consistently ask ourselves, if you have to hurt a child or medicate a child to pay attention, is there something wrong with our expectations rather than the child?
It's authority versus influence, right?
And if your child is acting up to the point where you think that they need to be medicated, please look at their brain activity before you select the medication. And 2014, I did a publication that specifically looked at all the kinds of meds that you could give to an ADD kid. And there's a big long list. And there's different methods of action. I mean, dramatically different methods of action. And each one of them have an EEG match. If you actually look at the EEG first, you can pick the match properly. But if you don't look first, you'll try this, take it for a while. Oh, you got a side effect. Withdraw from it and try this other one. And about three or four down the line, they might find out that it's actually a combination of guanfacine and methylphenidate, like Sandra Liu's paper shows, for the theta and beta mix that the person might have. So the combinations of medications might be needed, but anything from anticonvulsants to stimulants to system depressants to antipsychotics and Provigil. For kids who have inattention because they have a primary disorder of vigilance. They just can't stay awake. They have narcolepsy with no cataplexy. So the wide variety, but if you look at the EEG first, you know which one of them is going to be the match for the individual. There's, personalized medicine and evidence-based medicine. And I, you know, the that paper is out there. Actually, I see it's getting more reads now than it had when it was new. And I've got another one that kind of goes through the same sort of a thing, Neurofeedback in the Brain, published in Internet Adult Psychology, that thing. And now that's getting quite a bit of reads too. So.
Jay, two things before we go. One, please send me those papers. I'll make sure we get them up so people can see them. And then number two, was Horrible Helen a math teacher?
No. She was not a math teacher.
What subject?
That was a social studies.
Social studies. Okay. All right.
Social studies, you know.
Anti-social studies. Yeah. Dr. Marie Swingle, Jake Unkelman. Another great episode of Neuro Noodle Neurofeedback Podcast.
Have a great week.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.
Mark your calendars for Friday, April 26, 2024, as Bradley University hosts the 8th Annual Super Brain Summit, presented by the Center for Collaborative Brain Research. This year's topic, Rhythms of Regulation, Polyvagal Perspectives, promises an insightful exploration to polyvagal theory with Deb Dana, LCSW, leading the discussions as a featured speaker. Dana is a celebrated author and clinician, brings her extensive knowledge and practical experience to the forefront. The event will be held at the Hayden Clark Alumni Center's Peplo Pavilion, available both live and online, ensuring accessible participation for all interested. For those looking to register or seeking more information, please contact Gwen at ghowarter@bradley.edu or by phone at 309-677-3900. Further inquiries about the program can be directed to Dr. Lori Russell Chapin at lar@bradley.edu. Don't miss this enriching opportunity to engage with the latest advancements in brain research and polyvagal practices.